If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Drimple. And we are now on the big finale for our Slavery series. And I've got the wonderful Alex Renton with us. But we should fess up. This was actually recorded at the Jaipur Literature Festival last January. And we have an update, which we're going to go straight into before we go to the recording we made. Because Alex and a few others have gone on to found something called the Heirs of Slavery. Anita, tell us about it.
Well, so the Heirs of Slavery, including people like Laura Trevelyan, who used to be a colleague of mine at the BBC, there is a Gladstone involved. There are sort of prominent names from British society whose families benefited from slavery. So the Heirs of Slavery are looking into the development of programmes for reparations and apology for what happened. And, you know, Alex Renton's very much in the heart of this. There's also an organisation which you should know about, which is CARICOM. It's a Caribbean group of nations. And this has been like a huge topic of conversation in the Commonwealth as well, that they want acknowledgement, repair and reconciliation when it comes to slavery. But Alex and the Heirs of Slavery, you know, this is a new thing where they are actually going through line by line what their families did and what their families had and what their families may owe.
So the Heirs of Slavery want the European nations that were involved in slavery, particularly Portugal, Britain, France, and Spain and Holland, to acknowledge the CARICOM, Caribbean Nation Plan for Reparative Justice, which means a full apology, development programs for Indigenous people, funding for repatriation programs, building cultural institutions, help tackling public health crises, developing education programs, enhancing historical and cultural exchange, dealing with psychological trauma, the right to develop through technology, and debt cancellation. So it's a very ambitious and comprehensive plan. I hadn't realized it was quite so thorough. It's an extraordinary program.
I mean, it is a comprehensive program, but some may say from those countries, particularly the CARICOM countries, that it is about time. And that is what they are saying, particularly Commonwealth countries who say, you know what, if you don't want to address this, what's the point of being in the Commonwealth?
So now back to the recording. This is Alex Renton recorded in January at the Jaipur Literature Festival in India on his extraordinary book, Blood Legacy.
We want to sort of zoom in on a personal story which actually sheds a lot of light on some much bigger issues. So what if you are, I mean, this is why I think this is also why, you know, when we come to this notion of why is it so hard to discuss empire? Why has it become such a battlefield? It's because some of this stuff is really hard to swallow. Like the partition stuff we talked about, do you remember that it is hard for Indians or Pakistanis to acknowledge that sometimes their forebears may have been part of that bloodlust?
And when my book, The Anarchy, came out in India.
You wrote a book called The Anarchy? You don't mention it very often. Okay.
The fact that the Indian bankers, the Jagat Sets and many others, had actually basically funded the East India Company and had bribed Clive to fight Sir Raja Dowler.
Indeed. And so there are some things which are tricky to have in your history. And one such thing is slavery. So there are people who have old money that is built in slavery. There are cities that are built on old money from slavery. So how do you have that reckoning? Well, all of this comes together in a rather marvellous book by a man called Alex Renton. It's called Blood Legacy. Alex is with us now. And can we start with the very personal? Why did you start even working on this book? What is it in your family, the sort of the shadows in the family that made you do it?
So my grand Scottish family, who some of whom still inhabit an old house in Ayrshire, inhabit part of it, some of it's derelict.
Is it a castle? More of a castle than a house.
No, it's a 18th century house, but the castle is down the road. They moved out of that in the 15th century, but for good reasons. But I was there a lot as a child and as an adult. And there are wonderful family archives down below in the old servants' dining hall. And I was all catalogued by my historian grandfather, Sir James Ferguson, who died in 1971. And I was just going through his notes, his handwritten catalogue, and kept seeing references to Jamaica and Tobago in it, and asked my mother, who said, ah, yes, well, Dad told us not to worry too much about that because everyone was doing it, everyone like them, and we didn't make very much money and we weren't in it very long.
Did you know the it was actually sort of slavery implanted? Did you immediately put it together?
Clearly. 18th century notes about investments in Jamaica and Tobago. And of course, you know, as a journalist, an investigative journalist, that was a red rag. And to my family's slight consternation, I'd started digging into this huge archive, which really hadn't been looked at since my grandfather did 60 years ago, and tells a quite ordinary story of gentlemanly or landed gentlemanly slave ownership, slave trading over, in the end, an ownership in Jamaica right through to 1875 when the plantation was finally disposed of.
I feel like I've done you an enormous disservice because, of course, people who do read newspapers will know the bylines. They're just in a potted history. And why it should be no surprise to anybody that you're a man who just wouldn't take face value at face value. So what is it about you that made you keep digging?
Well, I like to dig. I mean,
you're an investigative journalist of great repute.
I mean, I think you did a bit like Willie. I had one of those bizarre educations that left me feeling quite rebellious and angry. You know, a posh education. I went to Eton and so on. And I think, you know, it happened to
famously
a lot of us.
You went to prep school with Boris Johnson.
I went to prep school with Boris. Absolutely. But and a lot of the teachers from our time there are now slowly being brought to justice.
Partly through your intervention in the law court.
It was one of pedo hunting is one of my and productive. And yeah, I mean, a sort of skepticism about the establishment, about the class of which, you know, to which I clearly belong. My family post slave ownership have been governor generals in India and elsewhere, politicians, you know, leaders in the British Army and so on.
Distinguished lawyers and historians in the Scottish Enlightenment. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the central figure, Sir Adam Ferguson, to the book, who is my six times great uncle, was an MP for Edinburgh and for Ayrshire. He was a friend of Henry Dundas, who's very close to Pitt. He was offered the governor generalship of Bombay at one point and turned it down because this is in the 1790s.
Dundas being the foreign secretary who we've met before in this podcast, because he was the guy that sent Lord Wellesley out to India to fight the French, and was very much the most powerful, not just Scot, but the most powerful man in the empire in the early days fighting Napoleon and so on.
And also a man that finds himself in the eye of a particular storm at the moment about reputation, which we'll come to in a moment. Let's park that, but let's stick with the Fergusons for a little while longer. So right at the beginning, they are almost immediately on the scene as a big, important family.
Yeah, I mean, really from the 17th century onwards, advocates, they were on the English side or the southern side during the rebellion of 1745, so they came very well out of that. And then quite naturally progressed into being peripheral figures in the Edinburgh Enlightenment. Close friends with Adam Smith. Yeah. Mm. He was rector of Glasgow University immediately after Adam Smith. And also, you know, this is where it got interesting for me. I mean, clearly for his time, a liberal, a Whig, a highly read man, you know, did the tour of Europe and so on. But he has a copy of every liberal text of the 18th century in his library, which still exists.
This is the crucial thing. That he was not, by the standards of 18th century Scotland, he was not a monster. He was an educated... I imagine he's the word decent. Civilized, but of course...
Yes. Decent, by the, you know, by the levels of
and
of
this is something
today,
you wrestle with in your book very beautifully about these are people which, if you were to take this chapter of their life out of it, are
would
people that you would not necessarily be would be unpleasant to have dinner with. They are intelligent, educated people, but they had slave plantations.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I first started reading the letters stored down in that basement, I realized very quickly that these were men of my time. When you read Sir Adam's younger brother who writes back from Tobago, his jokes, I mean, you could sit and... Our minds would merge.
I need to understand what that is. So when you say that our minds would merge, what do you mean? What was in the letters?
The letters are, he arrives in Grenada, which is a sort of great sort of area where all the new arrivals to the West Indies are in the great gold rush of the 1770s, trying to get the new land from that's come out of the truce made with the French. Lots of Scots friends, and he tells funny gossipy stories about them and how rapacious they are and how the lawyers are so naughty. And he starts judging his fellow slavers by saying, I think they're so wrong to treat the Africans so badly. Right. Africans isn't the word he uses. I think clearly you should show humanity to them. That makes economic sense and moral sense. God. So I immediately saw, and I had to start, you know, because I'm, you know, a chain of these people who have had this privilege ever since, to wonder if I had been me at the same time, would I too have gone out to manage to invest the family money in Africans? And that kind of begins to drive my thoughts in the book.
Yeah.
A bit of background here. So Scotland, prior to the 18th century, is one of the poorest countries in Europe. It's way behind France, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and England. And the reason that Scotland joins the Union is specifically to become part of the world of empire, which means on the east coast of Scotland, India, which is where my forebears went generation after generation and made money through both administration and loot. And on the west coast, it meant the Caribbean slave plantations. And you get huge numbers of Scots enriching themselves. And we Scots love to think of ourselves as the victims, as you know, we're the freedom and all this
stuff. Braveheart.
Braveheart and all that.
Colonized.
We got onto the bus of empire and we piled in.
And
by the mid-18th century, per capita, there are far more Scots than English, both in India and in the Caribbean.
Okay, well, I wanted to do the personal book first, but let's talk about what you've just brought up. Because also, actually, I've heard this conversation from Irish people as well, saying, you know what, it is very hard for us to come to terms with the fact that so many Irish went out to fight for the colonies. And you know, we've talked about the Jellialabagh massacre, where it was an Irishman from Tipperary who was in charge, and it was another man who went to Middleton College in Dublin who ordered fire, and there were lots of Irish doing some pretty unspeakable things. But is it not true, and we can go back and we can talk about this, and we will with your story, but is it also not true that there is an interesting introspection, dare I say it, that's going on in Scotland and Ireland that may not be going on elsewhere? Is that fair or not fair?
It's more complex than that, isn't it?
It may be more. I mean, we Scots, I live in Edinburgh, I'm a Scot. We like to flatter ourselves that we had the British Enlightenment. We've remained liberal and better educated is one of the things we tell ourselves a lot in all classes in the 20th century. And we're more open-minded to this day. Is it true? We've had, you know, the culture war in Scotland has been as gruesome over this issue, over talking about revisiting the history of empire, as it has anywhere else. It's taken some peculiarly Scottish angles, but...
I tell you why I think it definitely complicates things and makes Scots more willing to face this, is that, I went to school in Scotland, certainly to begin with, and you grow up learning about the Wars of Independence. And the Wars of Independence for us are Bannockburn and all the fighting against the English. And then you learn about Bonnie Prince Charlie. And the Redcoats are the baddies. The Redcoats, you know, are the evil villains of Scottish history textbooks. Mm-hmm. So every Scots child from the age of 8 grows up with the English and the Redcoats as the enemy. So therefore, when you're reading imperial history or talking about the Redcoats in India or even in Quebec or something like that, you're well aware that, you know, these guys are morally ambiguous. And I think that's crucially important. Certainly I find it made me much more willing to accept than many of my English contemporaries the fact that the whole imperial story is deeply morally ambiguous from the beginning, because lots of English people just grow up completely ignorant of any complicity in any...
Well, they have the toy soldiers and the goodies are in the red. Absolutely. I mean, it's like simple like
There's
that,
no question
it?
In my mind at all. It's a huge difference.
Okay.
If you've grown up to valorize William Wallace and...
Robert the Bruce.
Robert the Bruce and Bonnie Prince Charlie, it's very, very easy to understand how the English army, the British army, can be a force, a morally bad force, that it commits atrocities.
But, I mean, your and my Scots background is quite similar. In fact, we're cousins in some way, like everyone in Lowland Scotland.
Oh, my God, not another relative of Dalrymple. This is unbearable.
There has to be said that when I went to Tobago, there are, well, in the London phone book, there are two pages of Drumples. In the Tobago phone book.
Alex, you may not know
it's
this.
It's not my branch of the family.
It's a long-running joke. He's related to everybody.
Yes, but
he does kind of
go, not my branch of the family, quite often. When they did something bad, because I've heard that one before.
But sorry, back to you. Yeah.
We do bad things.
And my slaver ancestors lived in what is originally a Dalrymple house at New Hales in outside Edinburgh during the last period of slavery. But I mean, the interesting thing, like you, was brought up on Nigel Tranter. And when we drove north of the border for holidays, my mother would have us get out of the car and kiss the ground at Carlisle, because we were back in the land of the free. But your ancestors, like mine, were on the side of the Redcoats in 45. So for me, it becomes another of these retelling of this history to have the nicest history for yourself. And it's entirely analogous with the retelling of slavery history to say the British were the good guys and Wilberforce was a saint.
Well, let's now, we went on a digression. I don't mind it because it's fascinating, and also having two sort of Scots who are in this field in the room. Two posh Scots. But all right, there you are. Let's go back to you in the box of letters. So there you are. You're finding this stuff, these letters, which, you know, in one sentence seem quite decent, and then suddenly it's because you get a better price for a well-treated slave. Did you get a sense of what this family was, your family was like? I mean, what were they like?
Yes, because a lot of the letters are family letters, and they're letters, you know, as any doting uncle would write to a nephew, not least as Sir James, my four times great grandfather, who was a merchant in Bombay and then with the EIC and came back to enjoy his inheritance, which included the slavery inheritance as well. So I got a sense, I think, you know, most of all, that they were not alien beings, that though their acts were monstrous, but it would be wrong to picture them as monsters because they felt close to me. And then I found I got more and more, and their portraits were on the wall as I was upstairs, as I was reading this. And they had always been referred to as, you know, it's just that they'd stepped out of the room. They were still part of the family. But then I started digging deeper, and I found myself looking for good things, looking for those little moral tokens that they were thinking well. And then came across stuff that was just nauseating.
Like what?
Well, I think probably the first, there's a lot, but the first of all was when Jamie, the younger brother, sent out to Tobago to build a plantation and buy Africans from scratch, which is a fascinating account, writes to his elder brother, Sir Adam, who's bankrolling it, saying, talking about how he only owns 10 Africans at the time, but he's working alongside them, cutting down the trees to make the plantation. He stripped to the waist, he says, and he treats their wounds. And he's painting a picture of brotherly love and or labor together. And in the next paragraph, he has a design. He's sort of drawn a picture, a logo, which is entwining the initials James, J, A, and F for Ferguson. And he says, if you approve this design, I'll send to Barbados to have it made in silver before I mark the slaves.
Oh, God, brands. So, yes, marking the slaves is a sort of genteel way of putting a red hot iron in a fire and then burning
in
somebody's
skin. In the
center
of their chest. And it's a complicated logo. It's going to hurt more because he wants all those letters in. So, and later, of course,
was that the first thing you saw?
It's the first thing I saw that made me actually
feel
gulp.
Sick.
I mean, it made me
realize that these people were not actually of our world, though they had your name, that they had your blood, that they came from the same sort of place, that their values were utterly different.
And the key value, of course, and that this happens throughout, I mean, much later, Sir Adam Ferguson sits in the House of Commons listening to Wilberforce and Pitt debate in 1792, debate the abolition of slavery, leaves the Commons, goes to his lodgings in St. James's to write a letter to the manager saying, get down to Kingston and buy more young women because we're going to have to breed more.
Oh, God.
So what you realise, I realised about these men who I was growing to like were entirely racist because they were doing... They were treating the Africans like animals and branding them, breeding from them, and they would not do that to their white employees. And they had many white employees in Jamaica. So the whole enterprise is totally racist. There's no revelation, but no one taught me that at school.
Well, I mean, what did your family think? You know, I'm just sort of trying to picture what this is like. So you're doing
I'm intrigued by that. What
were family dinners like? You know, when you must have come running down going, oh my goodness, I've just read this thing. What did they say?
I mean, it's caused a rift. I mean, I think no one knew what was in those papers because anyone had seen was my grandfather's notes, and my grandfather had kind of covered it up to his children. You know, even in 1970, it was pretty embarrassing, and I think everyone thought I was going to write a sort of scholarly essay. And when the book finally appeared, they were angry that it was sensationalist, and also because this all started before June 2020 and Black Lives Matter. But by the time it appeared, people were wondering about whether windows would start being smashed.
I mean, we've seen the Draxes recently in Barbados be summoned to, who still have.
We should explain that. So there is a British parliamentarian called Richard Drax, whose family had plantations, and now there is a serious challenge to say, right, you owe money.
Yes, I mean, one of the nice effects of this book is that I have been contacted with quite a few people in the same position as us. They may not still be that wealthy, but they have the privilege of slavery and they know the history, because if they're posh enough, posh people keep their papers. So there's no avoiding it. So that has led to discussions about personal reparations, and the book's website has a page on various charities in the Caribbean and educational things that we are giving money to.
Well, I mean, there's that, but there's also, you know, I think your book is extraordinary, by the way. Really, I think it was hard to read. I can't imagine how hard it was to write, but you've got sort of a price list. Can I just go through some of the numbers, which are, I think, deeply, deeply affecting? Peggy the nurse, she was worth £90. Rachel was a maid, she was worth £57. Colin the child, and this was what did it. William knows me. Colin the child was worth £8. And then we also find out from your book, a horse was worth 40. Yes.
And the horses and cows are listed just under the children in that list. The lists are really gripping. And I do offer to share all my transcripts of them to anyone who writes to me, because they really shouldn't just be in our possession. But I mean, later in the book, I decided I needed to make a list of, because this is all about the Ferguson story. The enslaved people's story is not told and hardly known.
There
are a couple of stories that emerge. But so I did a list of, they only really recorded deaths if they were violent or from disease, because that's to do with the accounting and the bonuses for the white managers. So I did a list later in the book of everyone who, the 350 or so who died falling in the slurry pit or because of worms or often in childbirth or wasting away because of hopelessness is one of the descriptions. And those lists are, because this was a tyranny that, like the Nazis, lived through its accounting and can be read through its accounting. Those lists are deeply disturbing and moving.
Since we're talking about money, how much money came from the Ferguson plantations, and what was happening there, and where was it going? And I just want to people to understand this sort of circle of complicity at the time of who was benefiting, where the wealth was going.
Well, it's hard to disentangle. There's great historians like Stephen Mullen in Glasgow, who's very good on the economics of the later slavery period. And clearly the bankers and the insurers were making the most money. And we co-owned this plantation with the Hunter Blair family, who became very, very wealthy, but through lending money to planters. I think the Fergusons owned a lot of land in Scotland. I think at best it was around 20% of income. So it was very significant. They bought three houses in Edinburgh New Town in the space of about 10 years.
Out of how many acres in Tobago?
100 at the top, 200 enslaved people, and only about 200 acres actually under sugar. And then, of course, they benefit at the end of slavery, because we were still slave. I'm not sure about that word. At the end of slavery, we benefited from the compensation scheme to the tune of about 3 million.
And just again, and we have talked about this before, but the compensation fortune went to the owners. It didn't go to any of the enslaved people or their families.
And, and my ancestor, by now we're with Sir Charles Ferguson, who's my three times grandfather, was a well-known philanthropist, a builder of churches and schools throughout Ayrshire. But not a single church or school in Jamaica for the enslaved people who were freed in 1838.
This is a consistent thing in Scotland. And there's a historian in Glasgow University called Andrew McKillop, who's worked a lot, particularly on India. And he says, you know, there's barely a town in Scotland that hasn't got either a church hall or a church or a monument or a fountain or whatever it is, which comes either from India or from there. And you have this complete transformation of Scotland in the 18th century that comes from its participation in empire. And it's a very poor country. And then suddenly you have all these estate villages, you have suddenly all these big 18th century buildings, you mentioned New Hales, but the country is completely transformed in 100 years.
Because we've got listeners all over the world. We're very lucky on this. I mean, really privileged on this podcast that we have listeners from around the world. But if you were to take them on a walking tour, let's say, of Edinburgh, how much of Edinburgh and which bits of Edinburgh would be...
Well, can I just say, there is a really good Black History walking tour of Edinburgh, won by a wonderful person called Lisa Williams. And she will tour you up and down the new town, and house after house, some of them owned by my own ancestors, is directly linked to slavery. There's a modern history of Edinburgh by an old historian called Michael Fry, who you'll know, which fails to make any reference to slavery whatsoever, but
none at all.
Yeah. It's not in the index, but actually Lisa's tour will show you, and there are gravestones of enslaved nursemaids who were brought back by planters to Britain, to Scotland.
I did a lecture with
Andrew McKillop in Glasgow just 2 months ago, and this came up in the question time, and people were saying, you know, how much of Glasgow? And he said, I can't remember the exact figure, but he said, you know, if you were to go within 20 miles of Glasgow, you'd come across 50 estates which were linked to empire in one way or another.
The University College London LBS site has a brilliant map of Britain with its estates on it. And you see the clusters in Scotland, particularly mid-Ayrshire, and then up on the northeast going up to...
And I think you get a great deal of plantation stuff up in the Highlands too, a little bit later. And again, you know, like any business operation, and this was a business operation, lots of people go into it with high hopes, and a lot of people are disappointed. A lot of these families are writing that, you know, their plantations are not making money, and they're late in the game, and other families have got in there first. And so their concerns, what you read in so many of the letters, are not that, you know, I'm horrified by the whipping, the slaves, the early deaths, and all this stuff. They're just worried that their plantations are not making them the money they thought were going to bail them out.
Because they've borrowed deep in very dodgy banks in the late 18th century.
Can we talk about, again, the personality of these people? Because you also do this very, I suppose you're trying to look for some salvation somewhere, completely human and understandable. But some of the friend circle of Sir Adam Ferguson, I think, is utterly fascinating. So, you know, we're talking about key figures of the Enlightenment. Adam Smith, he knew. David Hume, he knew. Robert Burns, he knew.
Robbie Burns is a very crucial bit of the story.
Is he complicated?
So Robbie Burns is, you know, the most egalitarian person of the entire 18th century. He's writing about the poor. He's
the author of The Slave's Lament.
And yet he comes within a whisker of taking a job in the West Indies.
No, talk more about that. Because you told me this before and I can't get my head around that.
The legend is he had his passage booked. He had he called it being a slave driver is the word he used, on a plantation in Jamaica with another Scot. It was a route that many impoverished, educated young men, younger brothers took because it was a way to either die or make a fortune fast. And the legend is that he was on his way to Leith to get on the ship Roselle when word came from Edinburgh that his first edition of his poems was selling very well. And he turned around.
So again, you see, here's someone that we think of entirely
fluffy,
positive,
cuddly Robbie Burns.
Burns the attacking the establishment and standing up for the poor, but with a slightly different twist of fate. He could be remembered as a slave driver. This is, again, an important thing to remember in that there are many people who regard empire as an opportunity and go willingly and happily to it. But there's also a great class of people who are driven to sign up in the army, which involves a lot of brutality, or even worse, sign up in the navy because they have no money, because times are hard, and they sign up. And those people from the bottom of society find themselves committing exactly the same atrocities as the people at the top. They're burning down Sri Rangapatnam. They're working in the plantation slaves. They're watching slaves who escape being punished in hideous ways and this sort of thing.
Yeah, can I talk about the emotional sort of journey as well? I know it's an awful word. I know you winced and I don't blame you. I just wished I, but no, journey will be fine because, you know, you're there, you're looking at the letters. What washes over you? Is it what comes first? What comes second? Anger. I'm thinking anger, rage, disgust, shame. What order do they come in?
You know, it's interesting because it was a huge job of transcription. 18th century letters aren't easy to read. My father was dying at the time and my mother was caring for him. So I enlisted my mother. I would email her photographs of the letters so she would transcribe and I would transcribe. And we got into a routine of going, oh Lord, have you seen this? And she texts me something over. So she, and it was kind of good because she'd been brought up the same way to revere. Britain's big, in my class, are big on ancestor worship. And she saw what it really was. But I think both my mother and I, and she was very supportive of the book, not unlike some of the family, felt that we needed to take this story out to say, you know, because at this point we were getting to 2020 and things as I was finishing the book and those arguments, some of them very stupid, were beginning to happen. And just say, we acknowledge, apologize, there is no excusing this, particularly not on the grounds that things were different in those days. And so I think that one's nausea, which is very real. I mean, there's some stuff later where you read about how enslaved women whose white lovers return home and abandon them, but free their mutual children. Those sort of issues, you continue to be horrified by it. But I think as we went going forward, the idea that you need to take this out and that people like me and there's hundreds of thousands who are descended from slave owners alive in Britain today need to take part in addressing the wrongs done on racial grounds in Britain today.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a break here and we'll come back after the break and discuss what that might look like, feel like and sound like.
Aber was ich noch erzählen wollte, meine Nichte kämpft sich ja ganz schön das Studium. Semesterbeitrag, Laptop, Bücher, Software, Handy, Internet. Ey, so ein Master ist echt teuer.
Ach, sag ihr, sie kann sich das zurückholen.
Ja, du meinst von der Steuer absetzen, ne? Aber sie verdient ja nicht.
Egal. Zauberwort Verlustvortrag. Macht sie ganz einfach mit Wieso Steuer. Und wenn sie dann arbeitet, heißt es Katsching.
Das geht?
Safe. Wieso Steuer.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück.
Jetzt kostenlos ausprobieren.
10, 9, 8.
Halt!
Abbruch, Abbruch! Was ist los?
Hab Nutella vergessen.
Nicht so ernst.
Schmeckte schon himmlisch, bevor wir auf dem Mond waren. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Welcome back. So we are in conversation with Alex Renton about an extraordinary book and an extraordinary life experience. The book is called Blood Legacy. The experience was going through, sort of being the man rummaging through the family shame, really, in boxes and finding a story that's very difficult
to stomach.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think also, as a writer, as a journalist, you're sitting going, this is an extraordinary story, the descendants of slavers in Britain haven't really told their story. A lot of people in the States have, actually. There's quite a genre of writing about dealing with the shame of that and the aftermath of that. I mean, I got to the point where I thought, one of the things that's also shame is that none of my family had ever been there. One uncle who died, set up the plantation and brought Africans in Tobago and died after 4 years. But in the 200 years since, no one had gone. So I had to, my grandfather visited Jamaica just at the end of his life. So I realized that I had to go and I dragged my wife and my daughter out with me. She was 14 at the time.
It's a lot for a 14-year-old. Yeah. I mean, how open were you with your 14-year-old?
She complains that this story has been part of her life, but she's 18 now. But she, uh-huh. she, so to Tobago to go and go to the plantation, the Bloody Bay, the site of the plantation, and talk to people there and fess up and say why I was there.
How do you even start that conversation? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine it. You know, please tell me you didn't wear a white suit and a white hat. I'm Del Monte, man from Del Monte. I mean, how do you go forth and say, introduce yourself?
I felt a complete idiot, and people were incredibly kind and generous.
I was
searching around trying to find traces of where my ancestors' house might have been in Bloody Bay, in this sort of mountainous bit of Tobago, where the field, because he and the Africans cleared the jungle to make the first plantation there, and it's now kind of returned to jungle.
From my experience, Tobago is full of Scottish names. There's places called Culloden. There's, you know, wherever you go, Scotland is all around you. And secondly, it's very difficult at first to square it with horrors, because you go there and it's one of the most beautiful places on earth, and we're all trained in the 20th century to think of tropical islands as bliss, as heaven. And yet, you know, you see these, they look like sort of ruined windmills, which are the plantation. Well, they are ruined mills. You see chimneys, and none of these plantations, of course, exist anymore. They're all 200 years old. They're ruins. So again, not only are you brought up to think of a tropical island as a paradise, you're also brought up to think of, you know, crumbling ruins as rather romantic. And you have to make a massive jump to realize that these are not places that are gorgeous and pretty. They are places of horror where terrible things happened. But it's not like, you know, you see bits of Auschwitz and it looks threatening, and you see those gates and you see those stoat tracks and your blood chills.
There is nothing here that is immediately
it's different
aesthetically
going to a
chilling.
Slave plantation
that's
in Tobago.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
And you kind of get, I mean, this is, they call it the white gaze, going to the tropics. But it, I mean, and how, you know, we see a gorgeous place. To many Tobagans, you see, you know, who aren't directly involved in the tourist industry, a place of enormous poverty and continuing racial problems, you know, issues. I talk to people in Tobago about this around colorism, which of course, you know, discrimination because of the shade of your skin comes directly from the discrimination that my ancestors' employees used. And it, beneath the skin, it's really very clear. I rang everybody called Ferguson in the Tobago phone book,
right?
And got in touch with everyone.
Were there large numbers of Fergusons?
I did it in Trinidad as well. There were, because there were other Fergusons. So the George Ferguson, who became governor of Tobago and defended it against the French. But so there were a considerable amount. But those that didn't put the phone down on me as a complete nutter. We had the most wonderful conversations with.
What is the sort of the range of people that you were talking to with the surname Ferguson?
They were all black Fergusons. Lots of people in Trinidad and Tobago have some Indian blood as well, but I think most of them would have identified mainly as African. And we did DNA tests. I took DNA tests with me in the hope of finding some cousins, because I just thought my uncle had been there 4 years. He was 27 years old. He was unmarried, and white men were licensed to use the enslaved women.
It wasn't rape.
There was no social shame. Social shame.
It absolutely was rape. But it was,
of course, it was rape. But there would have been not one whiff of this is criminal activity. No. Yeah.
But when I say I had wonderful conversations there in Jamaica with the people still living on the land, what I mean is, in the sense of their generosity and interest in me and, you know, preparedness to chew it all over. And really, and I think, you know, I mean, this, later when the book was published and people in the Caribbean and Americas got in touch about it, the bottom line would say it was people going, why didn't you come before? And why are
now?
People like you never, we never thought people like you were prepared to talk about
in
this.
In every aspect of this podcast, wherever we're dealing with any of these issues, whether it's India, whether it's the Caribbean, what's consistently fascinating is that it is only now that many of these things are being raked over and looked at and examined. I mean, what were people doing for the last 40, 50 years?
Like, it's not easy though, William. It's really, it's not an easy thing. We talked about it with partition as well. You know, if you think that in your family, there are people who might have gone into a, you know, their neighbor's homes or train carriage and massacred people.
But also that you know, that great generation of post-imperial British writers that we grew up reading and so on, why didn't they go and look? Mm. And I think, you know, because they're very busy picking over the bones and the crimes of empire. I mean, and not in the way we do now, but And I think you have to go back to the fact that our education, your and my extremely expensive education, was an exercise in delivering propaganda about that empire, which led not only to us believing that the British were the good guys of the slavery story, but also believing there was no story, there was nothing to look at.
Okay, so here's a funny thing. I have sort of mentioned this on the podcast before, but whenever, I mean, I did a book called The Patient Assassin about the massacre in Amritsar, the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, and the revenge that was taken for it. And for many, many people, and particularly when I've done this talk in Ireland, this is a lot, because, you know, the fact that an Irishman was presiding over the kind of tyranny that was going over, the fact that it was an Irishman who'd gone to India and said fire, it's really tricky. And I had this weird thing happen at book signings where people would come in tears and say sorry. And I actually didn't, and I to this day don't know how to deal with it. And I find it odd. And I actually sort of say, but you've got nothing to be sorry about. You didn't do this. And now, so tell me how, you know, in that queue, where are you in this queue? And is there a difference between guilt and shame?
I think it's a massive difference between guilt and shame. I can't feel guilty for the actions of my ancestors. I feel ashamed that it took me to late in my 50s that I could begin to look at them, and that I'd lived, you know, as a sort of liberal, you know, metropolitan journalist type, you know, in a belief that because I wasn't racist, racism wasn't a problem. But this book taught me an awful lot about what's going on now, and that I should feel ashamed that in Britain we have failed to not just to apologize for slavery, which we'll continue to refuse to do, but also to acknowledge the rights and needs and to be in our country of the descendants of the people whom we enslaved.
And there are people who are maybe listening to this who are going to hate this and who are going to say, wait a minute, what about Wilberforce? What about Wilberforce? Compare us to America. We were better than that. We're the ones who ended the slave trade.
Respond to that. So what would you say to, so we are going to get those letters and we'll see the tweets. People will be saying, but Britain
ended
the slave trade.
Why are you running
Britain down? What's your response to those people?
My response is that, I mean, Wilberforce is no saint. I mean, Wilberforce, you know, like Dundas, were politicians who tried to get an amelioration, I mean, that's the word they used, of slavery through ending the trade, because they thought slaves might be treated better than if they were being brought in from West Africa. And actually, there'll be fewer early deaths. I mean, is it turned out that wasn't even true. But the idea that Wilberforce and the politicians around him wanted to end British slavery just looks like nonsense and is nonsense.
Why do you say it's nonsense?
There was no intention of ending slavery in the West Indies. It was just ending the trading of slaves across the Atlantic. I mean, this is backed by religious people who back slavery throughout, actually. But
correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always understood that from what I've read, that Wilberforce was motivated not by, in a sense, a burning sense of human rights, which is how we would kind of assume that he would be motivated, but because as an evangelical Christian, he wanted people to be able to make the choice of Christ themselves for free. So it was driven by to many of us today would look at, in a sense, like religious fanaticism and wanting everybody to be freely able to convert to Christianity.
Well, I mean, what some people at the time called religious fundamentalism. And I found some very interesting things working on the new book. But, you know, it was Wilberforce's insistence that the East India Company put a Christianity clause in if they were going to get their charter back. And the East India Company said, no, bog off, that's going to get us killed. You know, if you start meddling with those gods. And he then lobbied. He did what is a very modern lobbying to get it put in.
History of the East India Company. There's 20 years, there's a guy called, I think, Charles Grant, who becomes a director. And one of his big campaigns when he becomes a director is to allow and encourage missionaries in.
Yeah.
Which had been previously banned. And exactly as you say, the other guys who'd been against it were exactly right, because this is exactly what precipitates 1857.
Yeah. So, you know, there were people at the time. So you're saying there's rose-tinted spectacles about...
Very much.
You mentioned the name we should come back to Dundas. I think it's an unfamiliar name to a lot of people.
When I started promoting the book last year, I used to do a quiz in some audiences, and you'd go, when did British slavery end? What percentage of GDP do you reckon it was in terms of the government earning from the taxes in 1800.
Could you give us the answers quickly?
So it ends in 1838. That's the end of indentured slavery in the Caribbean. GDP 10-11%. Lots of people that looked at this. So a major, major part of financing the wars against the French. And the British government earned more in taxes from our estates. I can see this in the records than the Fergusons ever earned.
Yes.
So one of the big issues in contemporary Scotland is bang slap in the middle of St. Andrew's Square, in the middle of Edinburgh, is the statue of Dundas. When I was brought up, we were very proud of Dundas.
What does it look like, Willie, for those who
It's an extremely tall column, like Nelson's Column, mm-hmm. And it dominates the whole of St. Andrew's Square, which is where, when I was growing up, where we used to get the bus into Edinburgh from. And used to arrive in Edinburgh at St. Andrew's Square, either Waverley Station or St. Andrew's Square. And it was the first thing you saw as you come out of the bus station. And this is a guy who we used to be proud of because he was a Scot that took over England, in a sense, and ran the English foreign policy.
They called him King of Scotland, didn't they?
Yeah, the King of Scotland. And we were always rather proud that this guy had gone south and showed the English what to do. But today, of course, he's now regarded for very good reasons as an incredibly morally dubious figure.
And what are those reasons, Alex? What is that?
It's interesting.
About?
I mean, Willie grew up going into Edinburgh, knowing who that statue was of. I don't think most Edinburghers ever. They sure do now, though, which is a good thing. So, I mean, Dundas, Pitt's right hand man, fixer, eventually impeached actually for corruption, but Minister of War, Minister of Finance, and so on through the 1790s, and you know, as was the way, one of the great patrons and a great friend of my ancestor as well. There's 50 or 60 letters between them in this archive. But and Dundas in 1792 very cleverly slipped the word gradually as an amendment into the bill abolishing the slave trade. That it shouldn't happen immediately, it should happen gradually.
What was his reasoning? What was his working out?
I think at the time it wouldn't have passed in the Commons. It was actually, the bill was turned down in the Lords anyway, so it needn't have happened. But it became government policy that there would be a gradual end to the slave trade. So to Dundas's critics, he was the one you put your finger at for the shipping of 300,000 more Africans to death over the 15 years before the trade actually ended in 1807. His defenders, and there are some very vocal ones, will say it was just politics. He had to finance the British wars, and ending this source of tax revenue would be disastrous. And they also point to the fact that Dundas, as a young advocate, acted in a key case where Joseph Knight, who was an escaped enslaved person in Scotland, got the right to stay in Scotland and established in Scottish law that you could not be a slave in Scotland, white or black. So Dundas's statue needed a rewrite, and with talk about pulling it down in 2020, but a committee sat and decided on a rewording which told much more of the story of Dundas, who also is the man who sent 6,000 British troops to try and capture Haiti or Saint-Domingue and take it as a sugar colony for the British when the revolution happened there.
And this is now a big debate in Scotland, because there are some people that say, rather than just a plaque, the statue should come down.
Very few. I mean, I think Scotland settled quite happily around a replacking of it, most of Scotland. Mm. But there is a powerful brigade with some Scottish academics in it, some descendants of Dundas himself, Lord Melville as he became, and some red-trousered Newtown white men who like writing angry letters to the Times and Spectator, who will not let this one rest. For me, I mean,
they want the plaque removed, do they?
They want the plaque removed and Dundas restored as one of the great men
of
Scotland.
Yeah.
And the fight, yeah, like every culture war fight, has become ridiculously personal and vicious. There's a tax on the great man, in my view, Sir Geoff Palmer, who's a Scottish academic and a descendant of slaves himself.
Who is a black Scottish academic, we should say. Uh-huh.
Edinburgh is a small town and Scotland is a small country. When you go around Scotland, do you find people regarding you as a sort of traitor for exposing the stuff and washing dirty linen in public?
You know, I get some invective and I get a lot of nasty emails. But I mean, when I compare it with the sort of things that happened to Satnam Sangera questioning Empire,
or David Olusoga,
you know, people don't, and David Olusoga, who has had to take guards to book festivals with him, you know, it's nothing. I mean, I think that the learning process for me at book festivals and in comments columns in the Times and Sunday Times is I had no idea I was really innocent about just how angry people like me, middle-aged white men, get over, and women too, get over this, and just how poorly educated we had
been. So I mean, again, I just would point out, it's not just sort of the red-trousered, you know, sort of white middle-aged man. We've had Suella Braverman say very recently. We've had Rishi Sunak say very recently. We have others who say very recently, you know what, either let it go or be proud of the great history of empire. So when you hear that, what goes through your mind?
The standard, as anyone who writes on this issue will tell you, the standard book festival polite complaint is slavery has always been part of human yeah. life. You know, would you have us sue the Romans for raping people across Roman
Britain? The Antonine Wall, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the whataboutists. And the answer to that is clearly Atlantic slavery as practiced by the British is sui generis because it was legal, encouraged by the government, and an enormous earner for the exchequer. And it's also more important than slavery in other times in other places because it still directly affects this country today, because racism today in Britain is rooted in the divisions that started with slavery and the othering of black people. So that's the answer. You can't get it through, though, I have to say.
Alex, just to take it back into your family again, and this is something which I'm very intrigued by. You have written about Sir Adam Ferguson with his amazing intellectual interest, this major figure of the Scottish Enlightenment, and he's attending progressive debates and he's friends with people like Adam Smith who hate the East India Company. And in all those ways, there's somebody that we might be able to get on with, we might imagine. But then you come across him methodically approving of collars, handcuffs, chains, and brands. How do you explain that? And what do you think that shows?
What was he thinking?
I'm no historian. Lots of historians say that the empire was basically a story of violence and hypocrisy and racism. And I cannot see these men, likable and modern in many ways, as anything but entirely racist. And their decision was that they were able to treat the Africans in this way with collars and chains and whips and stealing their babies from them and selling them to whoever they felt like because they saw them like the mules and donkeys on the plantation. And this isn't something that was different then. Sir Adam's best friend and neighbour at the Kennedy of Dalwarren, another member of Parliament, was a prominent abolitionist. The clerics that he had to dinner around his table were abolitionists by the 1790s. He knew there was another way to go. It wasn't even that key to the Ferguson finances. He could have decided to do the other thing. With 200,000, mainly women, campaigning and petitioning Parliament by the 1790s to stop slavery, he knew perfectly well the arguments against it as a Christian as well.
One final question. What to do about it today? You're not guilty for the fact that your ancestors bought brands and branded people and kidnapped people and took them to Tobago. But what can people do today to make up for this? What should ordinary people sitting, listening to this podcast, taking their dogs for a walk, doing the washing up, driving their car to work, what can they do to respond to the fact that this was a huge earner for our country and hundreds of thousands of people, not just from the upper classes like your family, but from all walks of life, like Robbie Burns, were involved in it?
I think the first thing I'd suggest is do an audit of your own history. Go onto the University College of London Legacies of British Slavery database and put your surname in. And if your surname's at all unusual, you may find some very interesting things. And from that point, and a lot of people do write to me having found out those disturbing and interesting things, start to think about the way you lead your life today. The fact that our former colonies where we enslaved people and, you know, my ancestors bought railway shares to make themselves richer with the compensation money they got. Our former colonies are still much poorer than I are. Guyana is one of the poor, full of Scots DNA, one of the poorest countries in the world. And whether, you know, it is right that this imbalance persists. So we do need to talk about reparations, reparative justice. It's not just about money. It's about better relationships, education, about technology transfer, debt forgiveness. And those are really potent things. At the moment, unlike some other European countries, the British government is saying we won't even talk about it.
I know you said final question. This is the final, because I'm just...
Okay, I'll do hundreds more questions.
I think this is it's just such a prism to look at our own day and age. Have you taken the family portraits down? Would it be better to take them down or better to put an explanation of who they really were?
It's a...
you don't have the family portraits yourself, Alex.
I don't live in that. Okay, that's easy then.
That's the easy answer. You know why I'm asking. This is Roads Must Fall. This is statues that exist. Do you take them down, or would, if it was in your house, do you take down your ancestors, or do you tell everybody who comes this is who they were?
You explain properly. I mean, it's a good topic. It's a fascinating topic of conversation. I mean, why not be open and talk about it? I mean, other nations that have been through appalling periods and done appalling things, you know, a lot of people in the Caribbean go, why can't you behave like the Germans did after the Second World War on this? And you go, yeah, why can't we, actually?
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much. The book is called Blood Legacy. We've been speaking to Alex Renton, and, you know, it's really well worth a read. That's kind of all we've got time for this week.
Thank you, Alex. That was incredible.
Yeah, really.
It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. I read it in one sitting. It's an extraordinary book.
Well, it, until we come back next week, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me. Thank you.